When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set here.
Any program about science or scientists today is almost bound to focus on space.
Hey, Houston, the Challenger has landed.
Houston Station, we are ready for the event. Thank you.
Welcome to the first 2014 edition of the Space Boffins podcast in partnership with the Naked Scientists, with Richard Hollingham, Sue Nelson, and our special guest, the world's most famous astronaut, Chris Hadfield.
Woohoo! More than 20 million people have now watched Chris Hadfield's gravity-defying version of Space Oddity, recorded during his six-month command of the International Space Station last year. And in a moment, you'll hear Commander Hadfield talking about everything from fixing a space toilet to musicians in space.
The one word everyone uses to describe Chris Hadfield is inspirational. He managed to reach a far wider audience than almost any astronaut since the Apollo days, such as these children from Campsbourne School in Haringey, North London, who sang with him at a recent Canadian High Commission reception.
I think he's amazing and he's got a really good voice.
Why do you think he's amazing?
Because he's done so much with his life. He's gone out in space, he's survived, unlike some spacecrafts which have crashed. He's sung a song in space and he's come back successfully.
My name's Inara, and I think that Chris Hadfield is really cool because he went in space and sang a song there. It's really amazing that somebody can do that.
I think he's a very cool person.
Why is that?
Because he's been up to space, and in space there's no gravity, which is cool.
My name's Laurel, and I think he's really influential, and it's amazing what he's done.
My name's Cheyenne, and I think that like Chris Hadfield is like an amazing, inspiring person to other people, and I think it's really cool that he went up in space and just sang that song. And it's not that easy when you're in space and you have to do work, but like you also have really nothing to do at the end of the day. It's really cool.
I think he's done so well in his life and he's been so successful.
Has it made you want to be an astronaut?
Yeah, a bit.
Just a bit?
Yeah.
Astronaut Chris Hadfield singing with children from Campsbourne School in Haringey. We met up with Commander Hadfield in a basement room at the BBC, and after the obligatory selfies, which you can see on our Facebook page, we asked him to introduce himself.
Hi, this is Chris Hadfield, recently back from a long voyage. I was on this trip.
Now, if we could start this with a question. I asked our 13-year-old son, what questions would you ask Chris Hadfield? Sure. And he came up with a number, but I think this is a great one. His first question was, what do you miss about not being in space? What do you miss about space?
You know, I try and never miss anything. Like, I mean, I spend very little of my life looking backwards. There's so much great stuff going on right now, and there's so many challenges and interesting things coming in the future. I'm just sort of proud of what's happened, and I really don't miss it. We worked really hard. I flew in space three times. I filled the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth every single time, and so I came back from space just feeling tremendously satisfied with the whole experience, and it's like building a... I don't think the upper reaches of a wall miss the lower reaches of the wall. That's just a foundation that lets you get to where you are. So I don't actually spend any time reminiscing and missing.
Not
to me.
Even about the view, because well, I can imagine you part not of missing me. The toilet.
Yeah, but
the
view is internalized. The view is now part of me. The view is something that became who I am. The view is the view is in my head all the time. So I don't miss it. It's now part of a great way for me to appreciate the world.
Can I ask you about the toilets then? There's one incident there's one incident you describe in your book where you are fixing a malfunctioning toilet, taking it apart, while at the same time trying to coordinate a spacewalk of two of your colleagues. Just tell us about that.
That was my proudest day in space, in fact. I was sending Roman and Pavel, Roman Romanenko and Pavel Vinogradov out on their spacewalk, which is very painstaking, and the consequences of mistake can be really bad. So you have to be really dogmatic and careful. And you do it in Russian, of course, because you're talking to cosmonauts, but also you're talking to mission control in Moscow. They have specialists down there. So it's a very mentally demanding time. Well, just before they got ready for their spacewalk, the toilet died in the American segment, and I was the only guy there to fix it. Everyone else was either in a part of the space station that was blocked off for the spacewalk, or they were doing an experiment they couldn't extract themselves from. So if I didn't fix the toilet, it wasn't getting fixed, and that's not a good way. You need a toilet, whether you want it or not. So I was taking the whole toilet apart. I was elbows deep in the innards of a fairly complex, non-gravity-driven, non-water-driven toilet, and rebuilding the separator compressor. And then the Russians would call, so I'd clean up myself and wipe the toilet off me and then go whipping down to the other end of the station and talk with the guys and do the next step and clean up the hatches and close up and then back to the toilet and back and forth. It took about 3 hours. But at the end of 3 hours, the guys were safely outside. Their suits weren't leaking. We hadn't missed one step in the procedure. Everything was good. And I threw the switch on the wall, and the toilet went, which was a great noise to hear. And so it was a... It was, for me, of all days, that was my space highlight of 6 months in orbiting the world.
Is this where your sort of mechanical engineering background came into its fore?
Well, I grew up on a farm, actually. And, you know, having to fix a machine on your own is what farmers do. Your tractor breaks at the back of the fields, and all you have is a set of vice grips and a slot screwdriver, and you got to figure out how to make it work again. And so a little practical... what my dad would say, thinking with your hands. If you can think with your hands and make things work, that's a really nice trait to have developed. And I think I learned a lot of it, not just as an engineer, but growing up on a farm.
I don't want to dwell on personal hygiene for the interview, but there is one other incident I am going to anyway. There was another incident that you described the amount of exercise you had to take and being on the treadmill and doing all this exercise every day to, you know, keep fit and make sure that when you get back to Earth, you can stand up.
Right.
And you talked about sweat, and you had to be really careful that you don't hurt other people with your sweat.
Well, think what happens. Anybody who's been on a treadmill or an elliptical or lifted for a while, or even just stood at the beach in the hot sun, and you look down, and your sweat actually drips on the ground around you, or you have to wipe the handlebars off. Well, imagine if it didn't fall down, but it flew off your body at all directions, depending on which way you flicked your wrist or turned your head. Or, you know, that little sometimes droplet of nose, the droplet of sweat that's on the tip of your nose. Well, if you turned your head and whipped that at someone across the room, they do not want to be attacked by flying sweat. So you actually float a towel in the air next to you. So it's hovering like an attendant jellyfish next to you. And you regularly grab the towel and just wipe the sweat off your body and then let go of the towel and let it float next to you again, because you don't want to get to the point where this gooey mass of sweat suddenly burps off your body and goes and splats onto someone else.
The film Gravity, which I know you've seen because I've seen you comment on it, It has actually made people who have been really keen to go into space all of their lives suddenly change their mind. Did you think it represented the risk that's involved with space travel accurately?
Sandra Bullock described the movie as an amusement park ride. I thought that was about right. It's not, intended to be realistic. It's intended to be provocative and evocative. And the visuals are magnificent. The visuals
Do they compare?
Oh, the visuals, at least during a spacewalk, are better than any I've ever seen. They invented technology to make those visuals, and they were beautiful and very reminiscent of being out on a spacewalk. The storyline is, you know, it's all Hollywood, and it's not supposed to be real.
You didn't have George Clooney on board?
Well, just, you know, it's just not supposed to be. The character types aren't right. What they do isn't right. The orbital mechanics don't make sense. But so what? You know, I can watch a Batman movie and I'm fine, you know, or a Superman or Spider-Man. It doesn't worry me that web shoots out of someone's wrists. I think that's okay. So I don't know why it would be any different. No, it's an amusement park ride. And if you're thinking of being an astronaut, that is not a training film. It's just entertainment.
There is, though, a massive amount of training involved in being an astronaut. And given that Soyuz is the only way currently to get to the International Space Station, the number of people, the competition to get that job is immense, isn't it?
Well, think if you want to fly to space. I thought, you know, someday I want to maybe fly a Russian spaceship. Okay, and that's going to be a long time from now. So let's just think about that. Okay, I'm going to fly a Russian spaceship. Well, that we don't fly it in English. It's a Russian spaceship. All the manuals, all the procedures. Okay, so I need to learn to speak Russian. And, you know, the instructors, the professors, they all so I need to take all those classes in Russian. And if I take an interpreter, that's okay. But when I get in the actual spaceship, there's not going to be an interpreter there with me. So I first flew a Russian spaceship in 2012. My first Russian language lesson was in 1993, almost 20 years prior. It took me 19 years of anticipation and training just to get to the point where I could competently sit in the Soyuz and operate for hours and hours in 100% Russian. And that's just, you know, I want to fly a Russian spaceship. There I have to learn a whole other language. And we treat medicine the same way, and programming the flight control computers and operating the robot arms and doing star fixes and understanding the geology of the Earth. We treat them all with the same level of preparation and respect and training. So it's decades of training to properly be trusted to be one of the few people living on the space station.
But right from the first pages of your book, you've spent your life training effectively or preparing to be an astronaut, which I like. I like that singleness of
well,
vision.
I count myself hugely lucky. I love learning things. I thought a long time ago, when someone offers to teach you something for free, take them up on it. You know, you're going to learn something and then you'll have more skills. And you never know when those skills are going to come in handy. When I was a teenager, I was in a program called Air Cadets. Great program to teach you to fly. But I also used to shoot rifles competitively on a range indoors. Just learning how to very carefully aim something and control your breathing to try and hit a target. When I was docking with the Russian space station Mir 25 years later, we use a handheld laser to try and measure the distance between the two vehicles. Absolutely critical for distance and speed. And it's exactly the same. And I never thought, when I was learning as an air cadet to handle a .22 rifle, that what I was really training for was to dock two spaceships together. When someone offers to teach you something, take them up on it. Keep training and learning things your whole life. And I'm now finished as being an astronaut, 35 years with the government, and I want to go back to school. You know, there's so many things I want to learn, all different kind. There's so much stuff in the world that I'm still an ignoramus about that I just want to keep studying.
To be an astronaut, then, the amount of training, you say you've been training from the earliest days, and you talk about, you know, fixing the machinery on the farm and how that helped you fix the toilet. Yeah. Is that always going to be the case? Are we under some sort of illusion that actually there will be a time when we can all go into space?
I tend to lead my life that way. In the book, I call it visualizing failure. That's how I lead my life. I don't visualize success, because if success happens, then that's great. If it doesn't happen, which is normally the case, normally things break or don't go right, how are you going to deal with that to get where you want to be? That's what life is all about. How are you going to deal with the things that go wrong? And if you're just counting on good looks, then maybe that'll carry you sometimes. But a lot of the time, you're going to end up making a mistake or being nervous or being scared or dropping the ball because you just weren't ready. So I just spend my life getting ready. And that's what I think education is. It's just getting ready to do things better, having more tools available. If you have a toolbox, why would you get a toolbox and only stick two tools in it if you can continually fill it, you know? Before I learned Russian, I didn't really enjoy being in Russia. But once I could speak the language, it's a fascinating place, so deep and cultural and interesting. And I kind of view everything that way. Once you learn the tool that lets you unlock that particular door, life becomes richer. So I'm not going to stop now that I've flown in space three times.
I suppose my question was really whether the rest of us can be astronauts or whether we have to accept that it's going to take superhuman effort to get there.
I suppose with all the commercial space flight happening, all you have to do nowadays is pay enough money and you can be a passenger.
Well, I mean, I'm not superhuman. I'm human, absolutely human.
Not superhuman, impressive. Right. But you have to be, you're single-minded and driven and a lot of luck along the way. But sure. What I'm saying is it possible for the rest of us to be astronauts? And will we become astronauts if we spend, enormous sums of money? Will that make us astronauts?
It's sort of like saying, can you fly an airplane? The people that are sitting up front on British Airways or whatever that are the captain of a big airliner with 300 or 400 people in the back, that's a very highly trained person. And he or she has spent a lot of the years of their life getting their skills. But they're just another person on the airplane, and there are hundreds of people in the back, and everybody is going flying together. Space flight will be like that, where there are people that have spent their whole lives getting the skills to be trusted to operate the spaceship, but there will be, just like there are air travelers, there will be space travelers. And everyone's sort of an astronaut, I guess, depending, you have to figure out what the right words are now. If you've orbited the world in a spaceship, that makes you an astronaut. But it's your role is kind of up to you.
It's more like a space tourist, really, isn't it?
Well, or a space traveler, like an air traveler.
Space commuter, yeah. Even.
Yeah, and eventually there will be space travelers. And so far you had to have been phenomenally wealthy, on the order of $35 million to go ride on the Soyuz. Soon, I think, Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic will be able to take people up for the price of a really high-end luxury car, a Bentley or whatever. But there are lots of people buy Bentleys. It's, not everybody, but there are lots of them around. So that's getting into the range where a private citizen can fly in space. They're not going to be controlling the vehicle, but they're going to get the experience of weightlessness and seeing the world. And that's a really important first step. And I think it answers your question. Yes, we have to get there somehow. And I think I have huge respect for Sir Richard and his company for being the ones who are forging this first step, because that's what we have to do to go to the step after that and the step after that.
I wonder, though, whether people will be as inspired as they were by you just doing a music video singing in our son, for instance. When he saw it, he was just wow. And he's surrounded with space stuff because of ours. Sure. That was an important part for outreach and education. Did you always have that in mind, or was it something that crept up on you? Because I know your son was very instrumental in helping you.
Well, I've always wanted to share the experience every way that I could. Whatever technology was on board, I just did my best to share it, because it's way too good an experience to keep to yourself. But that actually, the recording the song Space Oddity was not planned at all. That was a weekend project I did as a favor to my son. And he did such a wonderful job of editing the video. The Canadian Space Agency approved all that video in a big hurry. We got permission from Bowie himself. And over a week, my son and a friend of his put together that video, just sort of like a father-son thing. And he released it just privately. And that one YouTube that he released has been seen almost 20 million times. And with rebroadcasts, it's hundreds and hundreds of millions of times around the world that people have...
Did you have to do retakes?
I recorded the vocal track. I think I did two takes of the vocal track. And then for the video, I just held the camera and floated around singing the song about, one Saturday afternoon, and just sent all the video to the ground. And then they pieced it together into different sections of the station and did a magnificent job. And I think it's important to look at, because it ties together the fantasy and imagination of exploration and the rest of the universe with the reality of the fact that we're actually doing it. It's not just a song. It's not a soundstage. It's not a special effect. This is a beautiful, iconic song and the feeling of space travel, but actually done in space by a regular person who's actually up there. And I think that combination makes it sort of hypnotic a little bit to look at. And I think hundreds of millions of people found it the same way.
Does it help, do you think, that you're Canadian rather than American or European? Did that, almost being neutral,
out there that gave it the global appeal, perhaps, than that an American astronaut would not have?
I was NASA's director in Russia, amazingly enough. I don't even work for NASA. You know, I'm a Canadian. I work for the Canadian Space Agency, but they'd loaned me to NASA, and NASA trusted me enough to be NASA's director in Russia. And I found that to be a great position because I wasn't an American, so the Russians would talk to me differently, and I wasn't a Russian, and the Americans would talk to me differently. Canada is geographically in between the United States and Russia, but it's also sort of temperamentally and philosophically and politically in between the two. And so I really count myself hugely lucky to be a Canadian in that position. And I think for a song like that, it emphasized the fact that this was just a person up there singing. This isn't, I'm not a rock star. I'm not representing some big glitzy thing. All I did was do my best to make a version of a great song in a place that really shows the song off to its best advantage. And I think that was a little bit contagious also.
I have to say, though, that you are now, along with William Shatner, my favorite Canadians.
And I know William Shatner now.
You
which
are
is amazing.
So lucky.
Yeah, he's a really interesting man. I mean, he's 82 now, but what a fascinating thing he's been doing for the last 15 years of his life.
But too scared to go into space, apparently.
Well, yeah, perhaps. But I'm getting to know him, which is a real delight because, of course, I just idolized him as a kid with as Captain James Tiberius Kirk. You know, he was superhuman and he was a comic book character. But as a human being, the real man behind that is really interesting and thoughtful and philanthropic, doing lots of good things for a lot of good causes. I have big respect for him.
Given the reach of that video and how far it went round, and also what you did with social media and everything, does it suggest that actually what we need is some artists and musicians and writers in space rather than, you know, straight down the line astronauts? We need people who can articulate the wonder of it all.
Well, right now it is right at the edge of our ability to safely fly in space. And it's really difficult to take someone up who isn't qualified, because if a person isn't qualified, that means someone else has to be taking care of them. So to have one person who's unqualified basically takes a qualified astronaut out of the mix. And that's a big trade-off to make, you know. And so we're just making it safe enough now that maybe we can start to fly people who have minimal training. But the space station is a huge, complex place. I agree with you completely. We need to fly the people, you know, the artists of the world, the Elton Johns of the world, who can decade after decade write wonderful artistic interpretations of life that help us all appreciate it better. Imagine if we flew Bowie on the space station, what he would have come up with. But it's, you know, we can't kill people in the process. And right now it's really hard. But there are lots of astronauts who are musicians. There are astronauts who are artists. And for now, we're just trying to make do. Eventually, hopefully through what Richard Branson is doing and the things that will follow, we will be able to open it up to people who have all different other skill sets that will help bring it even more firmly into the culture of the world.
So ideally, you want a musician who can fix the toilet.
Yeah, as opposed to the other way around. Yes.
Commander Chris Hadfield, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Really nice to talk with you both. And tell your son hello from me.
We will.
Thanks.
Commander Chris Hadfield, and you won't be surprised to hear that he was really nice.
He was. It was a real pleasure, actually, to... Inspiring is the word everybody is. But what I liked about him was he was down to earth. He looked forward. And I love the fact that at the beginning of that interview, he looked forward to things he was going to do, as opposed to sort of, I suppose, resting on his laurels, effectively.
Well, that's really interesting, because I've spoken to a lot of the Apollo moonwalkers, the moonwalkers in particular, and a lot of them had a meltdown after they came back from the moon, because it was that thing. Oh, I've been to the moon. I've walked on the lunar surface. What am I going to do next? And several of them really struggled with that. But Chris Hadfield, he's just going to do something else and he'll do it really well.
I don't know whether that means he's the sort of current lot are made of sterner stuff, or maybe it's just become more routine or more within someone's reach. Because in the 60s, becoming an astronaut, yes, it was a childhood dream for millions of children, but your chances of becoming one were extremely low. And now, although there's still low for most people. They're much, much higher. Look at these competitions that you can apply for. Look at the chances of getting into. You've now got European Space Agency, UK Space Agency. So actually, it's more obtainable, I think, now. And maybe that means astronauts are a bit more rounded.
I was going to say he's a bit more grounded. Mm. Anyway, we'll put some pictures of us and our new best friend, Chris, on our Facebook page, and we'll tweet them as well. Do let us know what you think about that interview. And we do promise to update for 2014 the spaceboffins.com website.
Congratulations, by the way, to Gillian Finity. She's one of the 1,000 people shortlisted to go to Mars through that Mars One call out that came at the beginning of 2013 out of a staggering 200,000 entries. Hopefully we'll be hearing from Gillian in person soon.
And that's the Space Boffins podcast. In partnership with the Naked Scientists, we're supported by the Atrium Space Insurance Consortium, ABSL Space Products, and with a grant from the UK Space Agency. I'm Richard Hollingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson. We'll be back next month with more from the final frontier. Thanks for listening, and stay classy, Space Boffins.
Thumbs up from Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield returning from his command of the International Space Station. Chris was the first Canadian commander of a spacecraft, wrapping up a historic 144 days on board the station.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.